We welcome you again to the Mormon Channel and our program, Past Impressions. I'm Brent Topp, Chair of the Department of Church History and Doctrine at Brigham Young University, your host for this program. And with me today are a couple of my colleagues, Professor Richard Bennett and Professor John Livingston from the Department of Church History and Doctrine at Brigham Young University. We're grateful to have you, brethren, with us today.
Good to be here.
Yes.
I know that you two have done a book and working and have done a lot of research on the early missionaries of the church. And the book is tentatively titled All Ready to Harvest. And I think it's really significant for our listeners to understand the work of the early missionaries of the church. In fact, even that statement's kind of a little bit of a misnomer because we had early missionaries even before we had a church. Why don't you talk to us a little bit about the spirit of early missionary work even prior to April 6th, 1830, and what role does missionary work play in the early revelations?
You know, I think, and many will hardly realize that there were individuals who either saw Book of Mormon sheets coming off the press, individuals like Solomon Chamberlain and others who began to preach Mormonism even before the church was organized, even before the Book of Mormon was published. They just got excited. They felt the Spirit. And really, I think where Joseph Smith is a real person, flesh and blood, they can see him, they know him. The early church starts in such an egalitarian way, in a sense. Joseph is recognized as a prophet, but individuals feel like, my goodness, if they've joined the church, particularly men, then, my goodness, I have a responsibility to say something and to let others know. It was such big news, good news, so to speak.
Well, and you think in terms of the translation of the Book of Mormon, that alone was a call for missionary work. The family, the Smith family, was so excited. How did Oliver Cowdery hear about the church? But through the missionary efforts of the family. And then he says, well, I've got to come over here and teach the Smith family. We know that Oliver Cowdery had heard that. Mm-hmm. And so, concomitant, if you will, with the early efforts of the Restoration is this great enthusiasm and spiritual movement to share the gospel.
And I don't think they necessarily viewed themselves as called missionaries. It was just a call to proclaim. It was that evangelical spirit because of conversion. And you know, I think
there was a spirit that was moving in that early Restoration from the very beginning. John was just mentioning about Solomon Chamberlain. He came to the Grand and Print Shop there in Palmyra and got some of the early signatures of the Book of Mormon. You know, signatures about 16 pages, all stitched together. And he took those early signatures of the Book of Mormon with him up into upstate New York and other places up towards Lake Ontario. And with that great love for the Prophet Joseph and for what he was doing and a spiritual conviction, and we got to remember that this was a true spiritual conviction and conversion, even before the church was organized, to spread the gospel. And that just is going to infuse the whole missionary program of the church from the get-go.
In fact, every modern missionary, every modern member missionary knows Section 4 of the Doctrine and Covenants. And I think each
of
us... Given
in 1829.
Yeah, and I think that if we look at that, we think, well, holy cow, this is what we considered the greatest missionary revelation. And yet... there's this call to serve even before there were formal calls to serve. In fact, I like to think of those early revelations as missionary revelations, and that many of these early brethren are called formally after the church is organized. As a child, I remember always thinking of Samuel Smith as the first missionary. Well, why don't we talk a little bit about some that maybe our listeners wouldn't know stories about as well as maybe Samuel Smith. We can talk about Samuel, but who else were some of those that would put the copies of the Book of Mormon in their knapsacks and away they would go?
So, Joseph Smith's father.
Okay.
Joseph Smith Sr. goes up to visit his family up there in Lawrence County, up there in upstate New York, right up, and even into Canada, crossing over the St. Lawrence River. And this was in the very beginning, even before the church was organized. So you have Joseph Smith Sr., and you have Samuel, and you have Hiram, and you have all the family that's involved with this kind of work. At first, the church is riding the family in missionary work. Mm-hmm. It's a family endeavor. And then, of course, it spreads over to others, doesn't it, John?
Even Thomas B. Marsh, for instance, is another one who, again, sees signatures. We remember that a signature is kind of a section of the book. And these brethren that are working on the Book of Mormon are speaking about it. They're excited about it. Really, the missionary program of the church is born of member missionary work, if you think of it. Because sometimes we think of it the other way around. We have formal missionaries, then member missionaries. But no. It really begins with the Solomon Chamberlains. Well, of course, the Smith family.
Also the Whitmers. You talk about a family. You've got David Whitmer, Peter Whitmer Jr., Peter Whitmer Sr., the whole Whitmer family, and the women in that family. It's a family-driven initiative in those early years. Yes. There's no question about that. And Oliver Cowdery and his brother and family as well.
Well, in fact, I think that is the very spirit of Section 4 of the Doctrine and Covenants, is if you have desires for the work, you're called. These are the attributes that are needed, but if you have desires, then go forth and preach the gospel.
I remember as a 9-year-old boy, my family joins the church. My parents had been divorced a year earlier. My mother actually reads the Bible cover to cover, then reads the Book of Mormon cover to cover, converts herself. By the time she calls the missionaries to come to our home, which was an unusual thing, she's already converted. But I can remember those early enthusiastic responses. My mother is talking to everyone in the neighborhood about this new book, Book of Mormon. I think that missionary work is born of the enthusiasm of converts. And of course, in the earliest days of the church, or even before the church is formally organized, these folks are excited. They know it's true. They feel the spirit of it. It's infectious. And boy, it grows.
And it's still changing their lives.
Yeah. And it's new even today for those who join the church. They get excited. And just as in the early days, not all of their friends and family are as excited as they are. There is some opposition, but that's part of missionary work.
You're listening to Past Impressions on the Mormon Channel. I'm Brent Topp, your host, and with me today are Professors Richard Bennett and John Livingston from the Department of Church History and Doctrine from Brigham Young University. We've been talking about those earliest missionaries, member missionaries, even before the church was formally organized. When we think of missionary work today, we are all commanded to be member missionaries. But when we think of missionaries today, at least I think of MTC, preach my gospel. I think of having lessons that we study and present. And all of those are important for our missionary efforts. We have modern media and so many things that we can do. What was typical missionary approach in the early days? What did missionaries do and how were they trained?
You know, I'm not sure that there was much training at all, whether they'd read a part of the Book of Mormon, whether they'd previously been baptized or even not in some cases. Many of the early missionaries simply hit the road. They felt like it was true. They went back to family and friends. They tried to touch those that were closest to them. But oftentimes, these new missionaries would just go from door to door. Hotels, motels, things like that weren't available.
Barn to barn.
Barn to barn.
Farm to farm. Farm to barn.
It was a long walk for some. And of course,
But wasn't that part of the culture of the day that you would have itinerant preachers?
Oh, it was very much like the Methodist circuit riders.
Exactly.
We followed that circuit. Brigham Young, for instance, is converted, and his brother Joseph up there in Canada, and they're following those Methodist circuit riders. System.
Yeah, so because we would think in our 21st century culture, that just seems a little strange to just pack up your Book of Mormon and away you go. It seems kind of strange that we would do that, but that was really quite common and familiar to the people of the mid-19th century.
Oh, you bet. Brigham Young has brothers who are into this sort of thing, and it's just common. There is a religious fervor. There is a religious movement, not only in the area where Joseph Smith is living, but certainly Western New York stands out as a place where religion was becoming important. It's a frontier area. That Erie Canal had gone through, and new things were happening. It was exciting.
So what would they do? I mean, you say they would go from farm to farm or farm to barn, but what would they do? I mean, here you say Thomas B. Marsh, for example, the one you mentioned, in section 31 of the Doctrine and Covenants, he's only been a member of the church. I mean, now we're talking after the church is organized. He's only been a member of the church for less than a month, if I remember right, or thereabouts. So these are not really schooled in church procedures or anything like that. I mean, as a former mission president, Brother Livingston, I'll bet you'd have been a little nervous with
a short time. But, you know, President Hinckley, during his tenure, really invites missionaries once again to use their own words, to try and teach in their own language. And certainly that's what our earliest missionaries are doing.
Yeah. So what are they teaching? If they come into and have a barn meeting, what do they teach?
Let me read to you from one of the journals.
Okay,
Randy,
that'd be
good.
Great.
This is from John Low Butler. This is in March of 1835. He's attending a Baptist meeting, and he hears two Mormon elders preach at a Baptist meeting. This would happen sometimes. The other churches would invite them to come. And he says, "I said I would go and hear them. My Baptist brethren opposed me, but I told them I was going to hear them for myself. And they then appointed two brethren to go with me, and when we got to the meeting, seated together, one on each side of me, the elder rose up to speak. And what he then heard surprised Brother Butler. I expected they would speak from their golden Bible, but they did not. And to my astonishment, they commenced preaching the first principles as set down in the New Testament. This astonished me. I knew every word they said to be truth, for I had a testimony of it. I asked them a few questions, and they kindly answered them. I told them that my house was a home for them, as long as they wished, while they were preaching. You see what happened that way. They would be invited to the homes then. And my Baptist brethren sat on either side of me and said to one another, how John is taken up with the Mormons. See, his mouth is wide open to swallow it all. And this doctrine will just suit him, for it is what he has been seeking after. So I invited the elders to come to my house and hold meetings there if they wished. I then started for home, thinking and weighing over in my mind the doctrines and principles that had been held forth that evening by the elders of the Church of Jesus Christ. My mind was lit up more than it had ever been before, and I began to see clearly the things pertaining to the kingdom of God. Now, this is John Low Butler. I'm still reading his diary. I continued to call upon the Lord and to read the scriptures. I was determined to find out more about these Mormons, so I went to hear the elders preach again on the next Thursday. They preached about the order of the kingdom, and I had never heard anything so plain in all my life before. A child could understand it all. I think that's classic.
That's a great statement.
They taught simplicity. They taught faith. They taught repentance. They taught baptism, and they taught the Holy Ghost. They say it all over the time. The first principles and ordinances of the gospel, and while many didn't accept, here's an example of a man who, this is what I've known all my life. Mm-hmm. They used the Book of Mormon as evidence of the Restoration, but they taught clearly from the Bible, because this was a Bible-seeking people that they were teaching, and it resonated with those people. And they would go from the meeting to the home, back to meetings, and it would circulate that way because it would catch fire with a few people, and then they would invite them to come on over to our home. And that's one example of how the gospel was taught in those early days.
What would they do, especially for those missionaries prior to April 6th, 1830, those early missionaries that were with their families? I mean, President Livingston and I, when we were mission presidents, boy, we were always teaching our missionaries that you extend that invitation to baptism. You preach the gospel, you bear your testimony, and you commit to baptism. Well, there really wasn't a church to commit them to, so what was the promise? Were they looking forward to the promised day? Did they know there would be a church? What was the commitments that what were the commitments that were being extended?
You know, I think the Book of Mormon becomes a main feature of the very earliest missionaries. Solomon Chamberlain comments that when he heard the term Golden Bible, he said it was as if something shivered from his head to his toes when he heard that, and he just felt like he had to learn more. So that the translation of the Book of Mormon, I think, is a major feature of the earliest efforts of the earliest missionaries, some of whom, like Solomon and Thomas B. Marsh, who end up talking about the Book of Mormon even before they're members.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Past Impressions on the Mormon Channel. I'm your host, Brent Topp, and with me are my friends and colleagues, Richard Bennett and John Livingston. And Dick, you were, as we were talking at the end of the last segment, we were talking about what the missionaries were doing and what they were preaching and the spirit that came upon the people through the power of the Book of Mormon and elsewhere. You wanted to make a comment about the power or spirit of baptism as well.
That's right. You asked about missionary work before even the church was mm-hmm. organized.
What were they being committed
to? You go back
to
Joseph Smith's own experiences. And what was it that he was seeking in 1820 and then later in 1823? It was to know his standing before the Lord. He had felt condemned. He was seeking a remission of sin. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he receives. And so you see this theme through the early pre-church period, if you will, a seeking for a cleansing, a seeking for a remission of sin. And baptism wasn't just, and in fact, it wasn't even a gateway into the church before 1830, and there were some that were baptized even before the church is organized for the remission of sins, so that they could have their souls sanctified and purified before the Lord. And we mustn't forget how powerful that was in Joseph Smith's own experience, so that he could be right with God.
Mm-hmm.
And it was with these early missionaries, so that they could be right with God, that they could have their sins forgiven, and that they could move forward sanctified and in the Spirit of the Lord to do this. And that's what was coming with this great restoration. It was the miracle of forgiveness.
Wow, that's
the
great.
The miracle of forgiveness.
Great explanation.
Which was the motivation for so much of that early missionary work. It wasn't just to join a church. It was to get their lives purified.
Again and again, as we read these early missionary records, we see many accounts of these young missionaries going into the woods. It's almost as if they pattern it after Joseph Smith. They retire to the woods. They pour out their hearts to the Lord. This cleansing idea, or just getting direction when they're mm-hmm. discouraged idea, very common. Missionaries in the woods.
We talked a little bit about also the role of the Book of Mormon. And we clearly see that the Book of Mormon, you referred to some of the journal entries of the Golden Bible or how it just, the spirit of that. How was the Book of Mormon used by the missionaries in their teaching, and what role did it play in missionary work? Not only in the convincing, one of the things that I would teach my missionaries when I was a mission president is that you have to convince, but you also have to instruct. You get the convincing power of the Spirit, but you've got to teach in such a way that clarifies things in their heads as well as having that burning in the Spirit. What role did the Book of Mormon play in that?
You know, today, in our day, we almost look at techniques and methods of doing things. Back then, of course, they've just got a book. It's the only evidence, and maybe even today it's still the only mm-hmm. convincing evidence that missionaries hand to people. But for instance, let me read from the account of Joseph Holbrook. He says, "The 2 weeks brought my cousin, Mary Ann Angel, and with the Book of Mormon to my house with her father, James Angel, and the Mormon, Elder John P. Green." So Elder mm-hmm. Green's the missionary here. "I spent 2 or 3 hours with them while my wife was getting dinner. This was on a Friday. I commenced reading the Book of Mormon, of course, that evening. But being brought up not to spend any time on a weekday to read, I thought I must work. And as my cart was in the field where I left it the day before, where I was digging potatoes, I went to digging potatoes, but I soon found I could not content my mind at work. I returned to the house, took the Book of Mormon, read it for a few hours, but as this was so unusual thing for me to stop work in the daytime, my wife became alarmed and thought I'd better be at work rather than spending time reading such deception," which called my attention again to my potato digging. "I had not dug long before I wished I knew with all my heart all there was in that book. I went out into a large place nearby where the thistles were very large and thick. I knelt down to pray. I no sooner closed my eyes than it seemed as though the whole thistle plantation was in motion. I opened my eyes. I could see nothing the matter. I closed my eyes the second time when it seemed as if there was a whistle wind among the thistles. Yet I felt no wind. I continued my prayer for the forgiveness of my sins, like Dick was talking about earlier, for the Lord to lead me right, show me the truth of Mormonism. When I arose, I said I would go to the house and read the Book of Mormon, work or no work. This was after the after part of Saturday. I read that day, the night late. On Sunday, I read again. My wife took the child in the morning, went about 3/4 mile to my brother's, saying she would not be in the house and hear such nonsense. I read, prayed a number of times that day, being all alone, and marveled much that the thistle should be so troubled at my prayer, and my wife should be so disturbed she could not stay at home, for she was always fond of sitting down and reading evenings and Sundays. I read the Book of Mormon through in 2 nights and 3 days, and carried it home on a Monday morning to my cousin, Mary Ann Angel. She asked me what I thought of it. I told her I believed it was true, and God was at the bottom of the work.
That's a lot like Parley P. Pratt's.
Yeah, that is. I was thinking the same thing, where Parley says he couldn't, you know, sleep and eating was a burden to him.
As religion professors, we wish we could get all of our students to read the Book of Mormon.
That's in right.
2 or 3 or 5 yeah. days or even a month. Mm-hmm.
Those are great examples.
But they would, of course, bring their Bibles with them. Mm-hmm. And the favorite scriptures that were shared out of the Bible were from Ezekiel, 2 sticks, mm-hmm. Isaiah, whispering out of the ground. They wouldn't necessarily so much teach from the Book of Mormon because it was new and the members, their people were listening to it for the first time, but they would refer to the Bible about the coming forth of another great work. And so the Bible and the Book of Mormon were used as companions in this great missionary effort. They would use the Bible scriptures to bring them to the Book of Mormon, and vice versa.
Good. You're listening to Past Impressions on the Mormon Channel. We've been speaking today with Professor Richard Bennett and Professor John Livingston of the Department of Church History and Doctrine about early missionary work in The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. It's been enlightening and inspiring. Brethren, what were some of the challenges that they faced? We've talked about some of the miraculous experiences that they had and the conversions by the power of the Spirit, but I'm sure it wasn't all a bed of roses. What were some of the challenges that those early missionaries faced?
You know, they had some very physical challenges. Where do they sleep? Where do they eat? Some people were accepting, but many, like today, were kind of rejecting them and wouldn't let them sleep or stay or wouldn't feed them. These poor guys are sometimes sleeping under trees here and there, and it's quite the account.
Well, yes, they're walking. Mm-hmm. Let's just start with that. They're walking hundreds of miles. It was a walking time, I grant it.
Yeah.
But they were walking, and they were wearing out their boots. I mean, they were tired out. I mean, they walked 40, 50 miles a day and barely see anybody. So, I mean, there's a little smoke on the horizon. There's a house we're going to go in, and we're going to talk to them. See, can not forget about the church for a minute. Can we have a place to stay?
Yeah.
Can we sleep? Can we have something to eat? I mean, it was just the basic things to stay alive
in this missionary
thing.
Yeah, the temporal concerns. I don't think President Livingston's or my missionaries had to worry every day about whether they were going to be fed or not. They might have worried about what they were going to be fed.
And don't forget, these are not rich people.
That's right.
The early missionary thrust of the church was an impoverished crop of men.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they came from farms. They had very little clothing. I mean, they were not financially prepared for this. We're living without purse or script. We're begging for survival. Then we want to have them listen to us as well. So you've got to look at the whole physical thing to start with.
So very real physical, temporal challenges that they're facing.
Which in a very wonderful way increases their faith.
Sure.
Because they are, you know, you don't read of anybody dying because they didn't have the food or anything like that. They are fed. They may go for 2 or 3 days without anything to eat, but they are lodged and they're fed. And then they begin to teach the gospel in that home by the hearth, by the fire. During the breakfast time, and what is it you guys got? What are you doing over here? And then they would begin to preach. But they'd be face to face with the physical impediments and the challenges. Then the Spirit would take over and the miracles would happen. They would heal people right in the homes. Jared Carter, one of those early missionaries, the power of healing was so central to the missionary effort. And they would heal one of them. one another sometimes. Isn't that right, John?
Oh, they would lay hands on. Sometimes they'd be sicker than dogs. You just really feel for them as you read through these accounts. But beyond the physical difficulty, once they got into these homes and... I served my mission with the Navajo people, where we had coal oil lanterns, were in hogans, and I imagine it was not unlike the very cozy atmosphere that could exist around a home fire, a fireplace, and it created a wonderful setting for these young men. But nevertheless, they did have some opposition, no doubt about it.
And here's an example, a classic example. They would get into the home. The family would begin to listen, and they would begin to think, you know, these missionaries have something. Classic example was James Adams in the early 1830s. He says, "I began to reflect seriously upon the consequences of being what the world would call a Mormon. I then saw that I had got to lose my good name, that some of my greatest friends would become my most inveterate enemies. This was a trial to me. For heretofore I had not known what it was to have an enemy, having thus far of my life lived in peace with all men. But as soon as I began to bear testimony to the things I did know, and tell the things I had seen, priests and people, friends and neighbors commenced the cry of delusion, false prophets, and every evil report was put in circulation that could be thought of. My friends and neighbors would plead with me by night and by day, that for my credit and standing among men, and for my family's sake, and for the sake of everything that was good, not to be numbered among that people, the Mormons. And so great was the struggle that it had some influence for a short time upon my mind, so much so that darkness again began to be over my mind, and misery again began to be my companion. And in this situation, temptations most awful were presented before me." So now we're starting into this, the spiritual element. Mm-hmm. Well, they are beginning to listen to the message, but what am I going to have to give up for this thing? I mean, this is a brand new religion. Everything we've heard is that it's some sort of crazy thing with a gold Bible and modern prophets. What does it mean to be a Mormon? I'm going to have to give it all up. And you see what they're up against. It's amazing what those early members of the church, and they were all missionaries anyway, had to give up to become a Mormon. Mm-hmm.
It's a small town or rural issue where everyone knows what everyone else is doing. Let me give another account. This is a letter dated only 1832. Wesley Perkins in Lorain County of Ohio, probably to his brother or a close relative, Jacob Perkins in Vermont. He says, "As it respect religion," and I wish I could show you the writing. We've retained the original spelling and grammar in the book, but "as it's respect in religion in this town, there's considerable stir at present," he says. "The Mormon religion excites the greatest curiosity at present. Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon is the head men in this business. Their God is the devil now, but the simple will embrace their doctrine. If you could attend one of their meetings and see the young girlies," or he says, "have visions, it would put you in the mind of the dog story I heard you tell." Must be something in the past.
Dog story. Yeah.
Well, it's capital D-O-G-G-S, so it must be some individuals. But anyway, he says, I heard you tell. It's paid no attention to only by those who are possessed of weak minds. I understand that Jared Carter was in Benson and had baptized a number and would start for the promised land in the spring, probably going to Ohio. It is nothing more than I should expect of the Carters and some of the others in that part of town. Benson's, whoever joins them will become a priest or a prophet or a prophetess. I'll send you a paper that contains a letter written by Reverend E. Booth." And you remember that
Ezra Booth
is the first anti-Mormon sort of writer here. "I will send you the letters, and you may have them. Satisfy yourself. Mr. Booth went to the promised land," he says. You can sense and feel the opposition.
Do you know, the thing that I, as we've talked today, and as I study the accounts of the early missionaries, there are so many parallels to our challenges today. Many things were much different, but many things are much the same. And there is so much that we can learn from these early missionaries. In our next episode of Past Impressions, Professors Livingston and Bennett will continue talking about some of the specific fruits of that missionary work, and we'll talk about how it applies to us today in sharing the gospel and embracing the gospel in our own lives. Thank you for listening to Past Impressions on the Mormon Channel.